No one wants to get picked last. If you've ever been on a playground where kids are picking teams, you've probably known that fear that you were going to be the last one picked. And what were we afraid of in that moment? We were afraid of being picked last because no one likes the feeling that people are stuck with you. That they wouldn't have picked you, but they had to. You don't want that feeling. You'd like to be picked first. You'd love the feeling. I love the feeling when somebody values what you can do. Where people think we have something to contribute, something that we can offer to the team. Laura and I attended an Indiana Pacers game on Friday night. It's a tradition we have with some friends of ours. They graciously bring us to these games after Thanksgiving, and they've done that for years. I can't even remember when it started. It's been years and years. And so we were, this time, sitting at row 9. So we were pretty close to the action. And when you're that close, you can see just how big these guys are. I mean, they are huge. And there was another Pacer on the floor, a Pacer named TJ McConnell. He's 6'1", and he looked tiny. He's 3 inches taller than me. He looked so short compared to everybody else. So I want you to imagine a guy like Miles Turner. Miles Turner is 6'11". He is leading the NBA right now in blocking shots. And he actually went 3 for 7 from the three-point line also on Friday. So I want you to imagine Miles Turner on an elementary playground picking teams for elementary basketball. Imagine that he had first pick and he picked you as an elementary school student. That would be a different feeling, right? Because you would know that this guy doesn't need me to win the game. He could single-handedly take on the entire elementary school, and he's going to win the game. But it would still be an incredible privilege to be picked at all. To be picked first, to be picked. You know, he could pick the worst kid on the court. He could pick the best kid. It wouldn't matter. But getting picked by him would still be an amazing privilege. Now, you might think, well, it wouldn't really matter then. I mean, it wouldn't matter. If you can't contribute, then what good is it that you get picked? I beg to differ. If you like basketball and you had the opportunity to play with a 6'11 NBA player as an elementary school player, you'd love that. I wouldn't care if I was picked last. Just to get to play with this guy. That would be fun. That would be enjoyable. And it would be obvious that you were picked not on the basis of your performance, but entirely on the basis of this person's grace towards you. Here's the thing, though. When it comes to those God chooses through whom he's going to accomplish his purposes, we often want there to be something inherent in that person as to why God chose them, to give us the reason why God chose that person. Oh, God chose that person because of how good they are. God chose that person because how he knew they were going to be good. But you know, the idea that God chose those people so that God could use them to accomplish his plans is as silly as thinking that Miles Turner needs an elementary school player to win the game. It's nothing but sheer grace involved in God's choice to use us, to use these different individuals. Genesis has consistently taught us that the difference between the patriarchs and the Canaanites is not that the patriarchs are better. It's consistently taught that. They're not better. The difference is God's mercy. God takes the initiative with Abraham to do what he plans to do with this barren, idol-worshipping couple. Abraham, the Bible doesn't say that Abraham chose God. And the Bible doesn't say that God needed Abraham's help to accomplish his purposes. So it comes down to what Paul says in Romans 9:16. So then, it depends not on human will or exertion, but on God who has mercy. So when we look at this story of Joseph, naturally we want there to be something that sets Joseph apart because we're uncomfortable with the idea that God freely chooses to set people apart. So we think there should be something about Joseph that explains God's choice. I think it'd be unfair for God to show completely undeserving kindness on sinners and not show that same kindness to everyone. We think that would be unfair. We do not believe God is free to show kindness on sinners as he chooses. We believe that God owes the same kindness to everyone, and so that means that the difference must lie in us as to why we're with God and others are not. I mean, think about it. If that's the case, if God does owe everyone the same exact kindness, then the difference has to be in us. We have to be the difference maker. Why we're with God and others are not. In some way, we think we're better. That's not what Genesis teaches us. See, it really is good when we see that God has shown kindness to us that we did not deserve. When we recognize there is nothing that sets us apart from others around us except for God's pity. That means that when we see dysfunction in the lives of the people around us, we don't write them off. We should never, never, never write someone off as too far out of reach from God's amazing grace. It is nothing but pride that thinks that we are somehow worthy of God's grace and others are not. The truth is, none of us are worthy of it. That's what makes it grace. And when we see God's completely free and undeserved kindness towards us, it keeps us from being afraid when we see dysfunction in our lives. There's absolutely no degree of dysfunction that can stop God's plans from happening. You may come from a very difficult past from a dysfunctional family, but you're not stuck in that. You are not the hopeless product of your situation. God is able to do whatever he wants to do in and through you. So there's hope. See, it depends not on human will or exertion, but on God who has mercy. So there's hope for dysfunctional families. There's hope for your friends, for your family, for your coworkers, for your neighbors. There's hope for you. That's why there's hope for these patriarchs in these stories. Here, especially in this last section of Genesis. Not because there is anything that sets any of them apart, but because God is a gracious and merciful God. What our passage this morning shows us is how dysfunction relates to God's plans for his people. Dysfunction is common, and people don't treat each other well. Hopefully not, but you may have observed that this week. In getting together with family, you might have observed people treating others in ways that they should not be treated. You may have treated a family member in a way that they should be treated, or a family member may have treated you in a way that they should not treat others. Families often don't get along. But what we see in Genesis 37, 2 through 11, are two truths about the relationship between dysfunction and God's plans. We see that dysfunction does not disqualify you from God's plans, and dysfunction does not deter God's plans for you. Dysfunction does not disqualify you from God's plans, and dysfunction does not deter God's plans for you. So let's look at the first of these two truths, that the dysfunction does not disqualify you from God's plans. Look at Genesis 37. We're going to start by looking at verses 2 through 4, so you can turn there. Genesis 37. And if you look at verse 2, it starts with the same title that sections off the book of Genesis. So verse 2 says, "These are the generations of Jacob." And if we remember from last week, that title is pointing us not to Jacob, but to someone Jacob produced. And Moses is very quick to signal who that person is. Because the person whom Jacob produced, that we're going to focus on, is mentioned right after that. The very next word after that title is a name. And so it begins with this background material on Joseph, just one of Jacob's sons. Verse 2 continues saying, "Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives." So notice Joseph is a young man. He's just 17 years old. And the text says he's shepherding with the rest of his brothers. And then the text says that he's assisting, specifically, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. So the word translated boy here would be unnecessary if all it pointed to was his youth. We got that from his age. So it's actually used here in a more technical way to talk about his role as a servant or as an assistant. It's the same way this same word is used in Genesis 22 to talk about the two assistants, servants who went with Abraham and Isaac to Mount Moriah. The text also refers to Bilhah and Zilpah as Jacob's wives. I point that out because in chapter 35, Bilhah was referred to as Jacob's concubine. Now he's not saying that there's anything different in her status, but it seems like we're supposed to kind of look past that, look beyond the status, just view them as one big family. Joseph is not viewed as more important than anybody in this passage. He's not superior to his brothers. If anything, the text actually has him in a lower place in this initial verse because his brothers are showing him the ropes when it comes to shepherding. Now the question is, why would Moses begin with this information? Why tell these details? These details are to provide the background for the next line, which reads, "And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father." So Joseph is in this subservient role to his brothers. He's their inferior on the job, their lad, their assistant. And he's doing that as they watch over their flocks. But Joseph is the one who brings the bad report about them. So how does that usually work? Do assistants report to their boss about who they're assisting, usually? Do you tend to report to your overall boss on your supervisor, generally? I mean, when that happens, something's going on. And that's confirmed when we look at the way this word is translated. This word that's translated report, what this word really means. This word is never used in a positive way in the Old Testament. Sometimes it's translated whispering, sometimes slander or ill repute, or other times evil gossip. The only other place that this word is used with the word bad is by the same author in Numbers 13 and 14, when it's used with 10 of the spies who went to spy out the land of Canaan. You guys remember the song? 12 men went to spy on Canaan, 10 were bad and 2 were good. Moses sends out 12 tribes, one who's a representative from each of the tribes, and they go and spy out the land for 40 days, and then they come back. And they come back and say, yeah, this land's flowing with milk and honey. It's a great land, but it's also full of strong people and fortified cities. And at that point, Caleb, who's the representative of Judah, he's the spy that went out there, he says, look, we need to do what God told us to do. We can take this land. And at that point, the rest of the 10 other spies say, we absolutely cannot take the land. And it says there, so they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out. That's the same terminology for what Joseph does here. Now, it's not that the spies necessarily said anything that wasn't true. It's the way that they said it and what their intentions were for saying it. See, Moses had just said, the Lord wants us to go take the land. So the spies specifically say the report the way that they do in order to tell the people, don't listen to Moses. Don't listen to the Lord. We can't do it. So what happens here is actually similar. Back in Genesis, the question we should ask, why are we seeing this? What is the text trying to tell us about Joseph, about the situation? The text does not tell us that Joseph's brothers ever heard about this bad report. They may have never heard about it. There's the assumption we have, well, they heard about it and they got upset. But the text doesn't say that. Truth is, Jacob didn't always address the problems with his kids. Only really did it if it affected him. So they may never have heard. We're never told the details of the report either. We're never told if it was factually accurate or not. We're just told, and Moses just wants us to see that Joseph made this report. And when you look at the word, the way that it's used, Joseph doesn't appear to be doing something good or wise. In fact, Proverbs 10:18 says, whoever utters slander is a fool. And the word slander is the exact same word translated report in this passage. So Joseph isn't an innocent bystander in the dysfunction of his family. He's an instigator. And Moses wants us to see that from the start, because God is not choosing Joseph because he's perfect. He's not perfect. In fact, he's a very successful instigator. Because if you look here, he seems to go from assistant in verse 2 to supervisor in verse 14. Well done, Joseph. You subversive little sneak. That's what he is. Joseph is not the only one with his hand in this dysfunction. Verse 3 reads, now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his sons because he was the son of his old age. Now, that's written not as the result of the previous section. This is more background material. And interestingly, Jacob is referred to here as Israel. So Moses may have done that, as Gordon Wenham suggests, to point to Jacob as the head of this clan, as the head of God's people. And so as the head of God's chosen people, his favoritism is going to be significant. Now again, the reasons for that love, it's not because of Joseph's bad report. Verse 3 says it's because he was the son of his old age. We might have expected that to be Benjamin, who's younger. And Benjamin is referred to that way, as the child of his old age in chapter 44 when Joseph is out of the picture. Isaac, too, is referred to this way and also is referred to as the one Abraham loved in chapter 22 of Genesis. So what Moses is doing in describing things this way, Jacob is older when Joseph was born, and he was born to his favorite wife, and he's just describing this in a way to show us, to emphasize this favoritism that Jacob has for Joseph. And Jacob doesn't try to hide it. Text says he made him a robe of many colors. That translation, many colors, it actually comes from the way that the Greek and Latin translators translated this Hebrew word. And the word actually more likely means that the coat had long sleeves or reached to the ground or both. In fact, the only other place that we have this same phrase is found in 2 Samuel, and it describes the special robes that David's daughters had. And there, the ESV translates it, a long robe with sleeves. The same phrase. Why would it do that? Because here's just the fact of the matter. You need to know this. Translations are scared to change things that have been accepted. So people that translate are scared to actually change a translation when we know about Joseph's coat of many colors. That's what we've grown to love and know about this story. So they're not going to change that. But all the point of that is just, this isn't a special robe. This is a really special robe that sets him apart from his brothers. And Jacob's other sons read him loud and clear. Verse 4 says, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Alan Ross made a helpful observation here. He noted, those who are envious often turn their hatred on the one favored, not on the one showing the favoritism. So Joseph has a target on his back because of Jacob's favoritism. And the brothers make it very clear. They can't hide that. They can't speak peacefully to him. It is obvious that they don't like their brother. Every time they talk to him, it's harsh, it's angry. They weren't hiding the fact that they hated Joseph. Now, there's nothing in this passage that actually talks about their brother's role in this dysfunctional home, but we do have the previous section that would say otherwise, that they're no better. We at least see some of the brothers. In chapter 34, Simeon and Levi massacred an entire village because of one person's unconscionable act against their sister. So, had they murdered Shechem after what he did to their sister, it would not have been right, but you could at least understood that. That's not what they did. They massacred the whole village. And then you have Reuben's egregious and probably calculated act with his father's concubine. And potentially both of those situations were related to Jacob's favoritism. So this is the family that God has chosen to use. They're all a mess, including Joseph. And the main point of this section is not simply to say that we shouldn't show favoritism, but that is a valid application here to think about. Favoritism, this sin of partiality, it's talked about repeatedly in the Bible. We should not do it. And what we see in this section is how favoritism just tears down a family. Kent Hughes is no doubt right when he says Jacob probably could not help his feelings of favoritism because Joseph was the son of Rachel, his deceased and never forgotten first love. And Joseph had been born late in life after so many years of frustration. But he's also right to point out that this was still inexcusable. It was natural. There are natural reasons why people are drawn to other people. Whether it's personality types, disposition, common interests, there are many reasons you might naturally connect with one child over another. But that only means that you have to work that much harder to make sure that you do not treat your children differently. Because favoritism does wreck families. And there's no excuse for it. There's no excuse for favoritism within the home. It's because of that, it's important not to just pat yourself on the back and say, I'm sure we're fine. But we need to be very careful. We need to actively evaluate how we may be showing favoritism as parents. So do you give your child who's like you a pass when it comes to the same failures that you struggle with? Do you treat the frustrations that your child shares in common with you as more understandable and as more significant than the frustrations that your children have that you don't relate to? You say, but Kurt, they do matter more. Do they? We need to be careful and acknowledge that we don't look at our lives objectively. We need to own that. So that we can't look at our life and necessarily say, I'm okay. And so we should listen to our spouse, to the people around us that are close. If they comment and say, hey, I don't think you're treating these two the same. We should listen to that because there's a good chance we are doing it. It's very natural. It's very easy. And it is also very easy to go unnoticed and not pay attention to it. And it is devastating. And the main point that we learn from this section is that dysfunction does not disqualify you from God's plan. So Joseph didn't act the way that he should when he told on his brothers so that he would look good. That's what he was doing. And Jacob was not doing the right thing when he showed this blatant favoritism for Joseph. And Joseph's brothers were not right to hate him in response. So this is the group God is committed to show his mercy toward. Now, you may have come out of some deeply dysfunctional situation. You need to understand that the people involved in that situation, they're entirely responsible for their role in that. The fact that God can show grace and mercy to us in and through those circumstances to accomplish what he wants in no way makes him complicit with what the people are doing. So God is present with us in the mess without forcing people to be good against their will. God's mercy doesn't erase sin and difficulty, but it is absolutely able to accomplish his purposes in and through that sin and difficulty. Now, the truth is, you may not be innocent. You may not be an innocent bystander, just like Joseph wasn't. And you may realize that. And this text shows us that there is mercy for dysfunctional sinners. You haven't done anything that puts you out of the reach of God's grace and mercy. And so what we should respond with a text like this, we should respond the way the tax collector does in Jesus' parable in Luke, where he says, be merciful. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Jesus said that person went away right with God, not the person saying, I'm glad I'm not that tax collector. So we need to remember, Jesus did not come for the healthy, but for the sick. Jesus didn't come for the righteous, but for sinners. And so there's hope for us. When we see these patriarchs, when we see the way that they really are, we recognize that there's hope for sinners. And we should call out to God for mercy. In Jesus, God's Son, there is mercy for all who call on him as Savior and Lord. He's the King who came and lived and died, and he rose again. And he did that to rescue sinners from their sin. And he showed by rising on the third day that he can save sinners. He can give us new life with him and for him forever. So cry out for his mercy. He will hear you. Dysfunction does not disqualify you from God's plans. The second truth that we see here is this. Dysfunction does not deter God's plans for you. And you see that in verses 5 through 11. So God is not standing at a distance from this dysfunctional family waiting for them to clean themselves up. He has a plan for them, and he tells that plan from the very beginning of the story. He tells us the end before it happens. Nothing can stop those plans. Nothing can stop God from doing what he wants to do, not even our sinful dysfunction. But what you also see is that God's plans, though undaunted, don't clean everything up immediately. I mean, in fact, things get worse. When God tells his plan here, it gets worse. In verse 4, it mentioned that Joseph's brothers hated him. In verse 5, it says they hated him even more. And verse 8 repeats that. And then verse 11 says his brothers were jealous of him. So first the favoritism from his dad. And now these dreams that are saying he's going to be great. I mean, what else could go right for this guy? That's what they're thinking. So things get worse between Joseph and his brothers. And Joseph is not faultless in this. Because we know that his brother's hatred was apparent. They could not speak to him peacefully. He wasn't ignorant of the fact that they hated him. Or he shouldn't have been ignorant of that fact. So what in the world is Joseph thinking in sharing his dreams? I mean, read the room, Joseph. No, nobody wants to hear what this dream clearly says. So either Joseph is a few fries short of a Happy Meal, which I doubt, or he likes rubbing this in his brother's face. Brother's faces. I think they would have taken these dreams seriously. Dreams were understood as coming from the divine realm. So they would have been seen as something significant, that he had dreamed this. It would have spoken of what was going to happen, this greatness that was going to happen for him. And so Joseph, who knows how his brothers feel, he was happy to share it with his brothers. Now, if you look at the second part of verse 8, it says that the reason for their increased hatred is twofold. It says they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So they hated him because they understood that these dreams were coming from some higher power. When they plot against him a little later in this chapter, they're going to say, we will see what will become of his dreams. They get that this is predicting something, saying something's going to happen in the future. So that greatness that they were looking at probably was part of the jealousy they felt in verse 11. So they hated him for the fact that this is happening to him, that he, the favored son, is the one that the gods or God, whoever they thought at the time, was promising this greatness. But they also hated him for sharing it, for his words, and probably for the way that he shared it, as we'll see. So God doesn't just bibbidi-bobbidi-boo all the problems away when he takes this action to do something, and when he does this plan from the start, things actually get worse. But we do hear God's plan here. God reveals his plan through these two dreams, and later we learn that God gives two dreams here. What he means by that is that what the dreams reveal is certainly going to happen and will begin to happen soon. So Joseph just dramatically tells his dream. He says, hear this dream that I have dreamed, as though this is a royal proclamation. And then he adds a lot of beholds for dramatic effect. He says, behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. So shepherds would grow crops too, And in the process of harvesting, they cut down these stalks of grain and they bind them together called sheaves. And what happens in this dream is these sheaves became animated. So like a person would, Joseph's sheave stood up, and then their sheaves start acting like people too, and they get up and they gather around his sheaf and they paid homage to it like you would a ruler. They bowed down. And Joseph's brothers respond like any older brothers would. They're indignant. You really think this is what's going to happen, Joseph? You really think that you're going to rule over us? But Joseph's not done yet. After harsh replies from his brothers, he has the audacity to share his next dream with them. He shares it with them and his dad. And again, he dramatically says in verse 9, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." I'm not sure what that would have looked like. What it would look like for the sun, the moon, and the stars to bow. Joseph isn't actually symbolized in this. These celestial bodies in his dream just surround him and bow to him in some way. Now, his dad's response is complicated. He rebukes him, it says. He feels disrespected. He says, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground to you?" He's incredulous. He doesn't really believe. He also doesn't seem to believe that Joseph would share this. It's not clear when he says your mother if he's talking about Joseph's biological mother, Rachel, who had died, and he understands this is just talking about Joseph's significance in history, or if he's referring to whichever wife may have adopted Joseph after Rachel's death, and he's seeing this as literally bowing down. But either way, he doesn't like what he hears. But verse 11 ends with, "His father kept the saying in mind." So that's actually translated, the Greek translation of that statement is this very similar to the one used with Mary in the incident with Jesus in the temple there in Luke. It says there, "His mother treasured up all these things in her heart." That's the idea. Jacob does not know the full significance of this, but he thinks there might be something to it. And so he tucks it away. He thinks, you know, this seems a little too familiar. That's what Moses wants us to see from this. This is revelation from God. And like Joseph, we can know that for sure when we see the end and it really happens. And as it does for Joseph, it helps us view these circumstances the way that God wants us to. We see that this is God's plan. What happens to Joseph is God's plan from the beginning. Joseph is able to look back on his situation. Having had this revealed to him at the beginning, he's able to look at the end of his life, look back at the situation and say, God meant for this to happen. Now, he acknowledges his brothers are entirely responsible for what they do. But he also is very clear. This is God's established, firm plan. Now, some people will look at this passage and they'd say, you know, okay, Joseph's dream is supposed to convey what's going to happen at the end, from the beginning. That cannot be. That can't be. God cannot tell the future. That's what they think. So understand what those people have done. They've accepted the worldview of our society that says God can't tell the future. Whether they say that because of a philosophy that defines freedom a certain way, or because they hold to a materialistic or naturalistic worldview. They have used a human worldview to interpret God's word. And they dismiss what the Bible clearly says, that God has established this plan from the beginning. Even before the people involved freely acted to carry it out. So what people should do when we look at this is we should use and embrace the worldview that the Bible is teaching us to interpret the philosophies and beliefs in our world. That's what we should do, not the other way around. So instead of dismissing what the text says here, that this is an impossibility, we need to respond to this by having greater confidence in what God has told us about our future. God has told us the end of our story from the beginning. And he can do that because he's sovereign over everything. That doesn't mean that bad things aren't going to happen. It means that those bad things are actually intended by God for his good plans. No, he's not the one doing the hating. He's not the one being jealous. And he's not making Joseph's brothers hate or be jealous. They do that freely on their own. And yet what these dreams demonstrate is that that hatred and dysfunction are actually part of the plan. Now, at this point, you might wonder, well, I wonder what would have happened if Joseph's brothers would have responded the right way to the dream. Let me just save you there. Hypotheticals are not helpful because what happens is part of God's plan. Now, we shouldn't respond to that in some deterministic way to say, well, that means we aren't free, or that means that it doesn't matter what we do. That means it's not our fault. Because God's providence is this mysterious reality that we are entirely free to do what we want and what we choose to do. We're free to do that. And yet, God is still sovereign over all of it. So God wasn't just looking in a crystal ball ahead and saying, okay, this is how I'm going to finagle things so that I get my way. That's not what he's doing. He is at work in these things to carry out his plans. He's not inciting sin, but sin is not able to do anything but accomplish his plans. That doesn't exonerate sinners or lessen the severity of what they do. The atrocities that people do are horribly wrong. And God has given us the freedom to do those things. But he is not, in doing that, he has not lost control. So that's the worldview the Bible presents, that God is governing all things such that even the atrocities that happen will bring about his plans. He's not going to make robots out of us. So we are free to do what we choose. And yet he's not going to turn over creation to us. He's still in control. Now, if that's confusing, good. That means you're hearing me correctly. Because it is confusing. I can't explain it any better than to say that God is completely in control and we are completely responsible for what we do. That's what the Bible teaches. And I am content, I'm more content with accepting that than denying one side of those two truths for the sake of consistency on my own part. So I'd rather accept a perceived contradiction in the Bible than to contradict what the Bible clearly teaches in order to make me feel like I'm being more consistent. I say that because I know that there are things that are beyond my understanding. And so I am going to choose to trust God and his revelation rather than try to make it fit my understanding. Now, what does that mean for us? It means that our dysfunction cannot deter God's plans for us. You may be in a mess. You may be in a situation you cannot see your way out of. What you need to do in that situation is entrust yourself to the God who can see you through it. He may not take you away those problems. He will see you through those problems. Bad things may happen. Really bad things may happen. But it doesn't mean God isn't there with you. It doesn't mean that God's plans aren't working out. It doesn't mean he's lost control. God is working out his good in our lives, even through the bad things that we experience. So what we need to do in those situations is hold on to what he's revealed to us. And you know what he's revealed to us is actually very similar to what he revealed to Joseph. Because in the end, we reign. In the end, we reign with Christ. That's the promise. Joseph's told, in the end, you reign. We're told the same thing. So when you look at the world, it may seem like there's no way things are going to end out okay. The Bible tells us that the same Jesus who came at his first advent and lived and died and rose again, he ascended to heaven and he's coming back again. And it tells us from the beginning that that's our end, that he is going to come back, he's going to reign, and we're going to reign with him. Everything that we experience in the present is working toward that end. So we can trust him. So we shouldn't lose hope when difficulties come. We shouldn't lose heart when you find yourself in a dysfunctional situation where nobody's treating each other the way that they should. You can be faithful because you know that dysfunction does not deter God's plans for you. Your broken situation may create a lot of stress in your life. It may create a lot of burdens. But you need to understand that those experiences, what you're going through, is actually part of God's plan. That's what's going to keep you from being bitter. That's what's going to keep you from being angry, because you should not be bitter. You should not be angry. And in that moment, you need to entrust yourself to God. Now, I know that's hard. I know it's hard. But when you see God's sovereignty the way that it is in the Bible, when you get a glimpse of the fact that God has this all worked out, God knows every step you take before you take it. God knows every letdown you're going to experience before you experience it. And when you see that God is actually working out those things for your good, then you can trust him. It's this good that he mentions in Romans 8 for those who love God. So families are dysfunctional. Relationships are messy. People are not going to treat us the right way. But that should not be an excuse for us to treat them the same way. We're different. We actually have hope. We can do what God calls us to do. We can love our enemies. We can do good to those who mistreat us. We can do that because, unlike Joseph and his family, we know this God who plans the end from the beginning. So that dysfunction can't stop God's plans. That dysfunction is actually part of God's plans. And those plans are to make us more and more like Christ by the power of his Spirit. That's what those things are doing. God has planned for that mistreatment so that you will become what he wants you to be. And because of that, we can entrust ourselves to God. And understand, this is his gracious mercy towards us. The fact that he's working these things out for our good, that's his mercy, that's his grace. We don't deserve that. So we should rest in that mercy. Rest that in the fact that he mercifully chose to save us. Not because we stood out, not because we had anything to offer him. That was this amazing privilege. And the truth is, we are no better than the people around us who are mistreating us. We are no better. The only difference is God's mercy. And we should want them to experience that too. Join me in prayer. Father, you call us to do what is difficult for sinners to do. We don't naturally want to respond the way that you call us to by your word. We naturally want to get even when people mistreat us. I naturally want to get even when somebody says something that I don't like, does something that I don't like. And yet you reveal time and time again that these things are all a part of your plan for us to make us into the image of your son. So help me, help us rest in that truth with confidence to know that nothing happens to us that is outside of your control. And as hard as that is, when we experience very difficult, bad things, that we would be able to rest in you in that moment. Rest in your goodness even when it doesn't make sense to us. Rest in your love. To know that you are wiser than we are. To know that you are the one who is good, that we are only able to be good in connection with you. Pray that we would rest in that truth, to know that you do have us in your hands, that your plans will succeed, and that we would respond the way that you call us to, that we would respond like our Savior responded when he was mistreated. Father, for anyone in here who feels like their life is too much of a mess for you to really accept them, pray that you would demonstrate, even through Joseph, through this story, through our lives, that we all know the truth. None of us are worthy of your acceptance. That they would recognize your mercy toward them. They would turn and they would trust in Jesus. They would follow him on not on the basis of what they can offer, what they can bring to the table, but on the basis of your grace. Pray that we would live that out in our world. Live out the reality that we know it is nothing but your grace that has been the difference in our life. And we would not write anyone off. That like your son, we would live this amazing love out, not powered by our strength, but powered by your spirit. And that others would see it and that they would glorify you by turning and trusting in you in that same way. Amen.